It's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil.
No combination of solar or wind or tidal or nuclear or biodiesel or ethanol or used French fried potato oil is going to allow us to keep Walmart and the interstate highway system and Walt Disney World running.
Don't give me no shit about blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the price of oil.
How will our cities and farms survive declining oil supplies? James Howard Kunstler is a persistent critic of suburbs, mega highways, and soulless strip malls. His two best-known books are The Geography of Nowhere and, more recently, The Long Emergency. Now Kunstler was appointed the first visiting scholar to the Urban Studies program of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. This speech captivated the overflow crowd at the SFU WASC Center in Vancouver, January 24, 2008. Out-of-town listeners should know that Surrey is a more or less unplanned bubble of suburbia outside Vancouver. Substitute your own satellite growth. Here is James Howard Kunstler.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Actually, I'm going to try to be on my best behavior tonight because I'm in Canada where people are polite. And I think you should act like the people who live in the country you're visiting. So I'll try to be very polite. And it has been kind of a humbling experience to be in Vancouver and to see this very interesting and complicated city that is so different from really 90% of the cities in the U.S. And I go around to a lot of them, you know. And some of the cities in the U.S. are still pretty alive. Although I have a lot of questions about, whether they're going to continue to function at the scale that they've achieved, and indeed, really throughout this whole blab, one of the themes really is going to be at what scale can we conduct all of the important activities that make up our everyday life. But it's also been humbling because. I've run into a lot of people over the last few days who have opinions that are quite different from mine. And, frankly, they may be just as valid as mine are, but they can't contradict my ideas. So, all of this is to say that the ideas I'm going to present are my point of view, admittedly. That, I'm not trying to represent any group or anything. I've just these are just the conclusions that I've come to from living in the culture that I live in, that we partially share. And so you can take them for what they are worth. This is, I gave a talk in Surrey at the Surrey campus a few days ago. And this talk contains about 37% of similar material, for those of you who happen to maybe have been to the other one. But it's not the same one. The Surrey talk was much more about the particulars of urban design per se. This is more about the nature of the predicament that we're in, but especially the group psychology of it, which fascinates me more and more. Why we do the things that, why do we continue doing the things that we're doing? And of course, at the center of a lot of this is the whole issue of oil. Of course, the United States, my country, faces a great deal of trouble over this. We use a quarter of the world's oil every day. We started the oil industry and ramped it up to be the world's first great oil industry. But we got started pretty early, and we peaked pretty early in 1970. And now there's a great deal of apprehension and anxiety that the world is peaking. When the United States, and by the way, I'm going to condense to some extent the oil discussion. I'm not going to go into a full-blown discussion of the so-called peak oil theory. And I'm more interested in sort of the current situation and the consequences. But when the United States peaked in its oil production at about 10 million barrels a day in 1970, We began to then offset our problem as our production declined. We offset our declines by importing oil from other nations. Now that the world appears to have reached an oil production peak, we're not going to be able to go to other planets to import or to offset the falling production, and that's the problem, the essence of the problem. There are other facets of it we'll get into. Another important part of this is that it's not about running out of oil. You know, all the radio jockeys I talk to are you saying we're running out of oil? Why we're not running out of oil? It's not about running out of oil. It's about what happens as you head down that slope, that arc of depletion, and weird things start happening. Namely, the complex systems that we depend on for everyday life start to get into trouble, start to react to these problems, start to wobble, start to fail, and start to then ramify each other's failings. And these complex systems can be described with some precision. The way we produce our food, farming, in particular industrial agriculture, the way we do commerce and trade and manufacturing, namely making stuff and selling it, which has now become basically the Walmart model of the global corporation, national chain corporation with the huge supply lines all over the world, et cetera, et cetera. That's another complex system. The way we do transportation, get from one place to another, you know, the whole happy motoring paradigm, that's another complex system. The way we do schooling. Finance is one of particular interest to me, and perhaps to some of you who are observing the scene out there. You know, finance, in a way, is one of the real canaries in the coal mine, because finance is it is in the nature of finance to operate by attempting to predict the future, to apprehend the future and understand the future and make sense of it by assigning prices to things. And one of the things we're seeing is that the stock and trade of finance, which is consists of certificates and currencies and paper markers that represent the expectation for wealth, these things are getting into trouble. They're losing their legitimacy. People are losing their confidence in them. And there's a reason why, because one of the major implications of the global oil predicament is that the sort of normal 2.5% to 9% growth that industrial economies enjoy year after year in a cyclical way, you know, some a little bit less one year, a little bit more next year, but always 3% to 9% industrial growth in industrial economies for 200 years. You know, this experience we've had. And in those 200 years, the stock markets have all grown up into their present form, and all of the instruments and certificates that they trade in have evolved to, you know, in their little niches to represent little pieces of risk and, you know, enterprise ventures into enterprise. And all of a sudden, the main implication in finance of the oil problem is that we're not going to have that regular 2.5% to 9% growth, and hence the expectation or wish for that kind of normal behavior is not there. And it means that the things that represent that wish are going to start to destabilize. And that's exactly what you're seeing. But there are really interesting side elements of it. And since I'm so interested in the group psychology, you know, it fascinates me, for example. And I think this is, you know, I do believe more and more in a kind of collective subconscious or collective imagination and collective psychology. Because as, you know, as this problem got closer to us, you saw a lot of really inexplicable behavior on the part of people working in finance. You know, most notably, for the last 10 years down in the United States, all the bankers in the United States forgot that you need to lend money to people who have some prospect for paying it back. That's a system called norms and standards in lending. And how do you account for the fact that everybody in banking forgot it, you know, or just put it aside, you know, including people who are supposedly really smart? You know, so my explanation for that is that, you know, as this situation evolves and gets scarier and more unstable, that groups of people, including groups of professionals, sort of crack up and to some extent become kind of culturally psychotic within their own culture. You know, there's no question that the culture of finance became psychotic over the last 10 years. No other way of sort of explaining the perverse behavior that we've been seeing. And now, of course, as Robert Louis Stevenson says, we're feasting at the banquet of consequences over that. Well, getting back to my point, all these complex systems that we depend on are going to get into trouble. You know, as we get in trouble with oil depletion, the food system is going to get in trouble because we're going to, and that's exactly what's happening. Of course, it costs more and more to run the diesel combines and trucks and to make the fertilizer. We saw an interesting thing happen with the fertilizer the last 5 years. When the price of natural gas really started to ramp up in 2003, a lot of the fertilizer plants in Arkansas and Louisiana closed down, moved their operations to the Middle East because the natural gas, which is the main constituent for nitrogenous fertilizer, is much cheaper over there. And one of the consequences of that now is that we are now hostages for our food production for the fertilizer produced in the Middle East, not just the oil and gasoline. So interesting things are happening, and there are other elements of that, the food scene that we'll talk about. But it's all about the complex systems and what happens. Now, over the last, about the last 2 years, some new storylines have been emerging in the larger oil soap opera. And they help us understand a little bit better how things will play out. And one of them is the oil export crisis. And what this simply means is we're discovering, as it appears that we passed the global peak in July of 2006, it appears that the numbers are telling us that the export rates in the nations that export oil are going down more steeply than their decline rates. So let's say a nation like Norway is now having a 4% decline every year in the North Sea of their production. You know, their export rates are going down even more steeply. For the really highly populated nations like Saudi Arabia, it's even more steep. And Iran, Venezuela, Mexico especially. We'll get to that in a moment. The second new rub on the story is the whole plot line about oil nationalism. And this sort of has two elements to it. One is that only about 5% of the world's oil comes from the major oil producers like Shell, the private major oil companies, they used to call them the old majors, Shell, Exxon, etc. 95% of the world's oil now is coming from nationalized oil companies like Pemex and the Venezuelan National Oil Company and the Brazilian National Oil Company, Saudi Aramco, etc., the Iranian National Oil, the Russian companies, for all practical purposes, have their operations are now pretty much nationalized, etc., etc. And they are increasingly making favored nations, favored customer contracts instead of putting their oil on the futures markets for auction. And that is going to increase more and more. It is happening more and more. And the United States, for one reason or another, is not so favored by many of these nations anymore. This is a problem for your south of the border neighbors. The North Sea and the United Kingdom are an interesting story, of course. The North Sea oil fields were among the last great fields to be discovered. They are shared by Norway and the UK. The UK has about 60 million people, and they not only sold off a great deal of their oil, but they also used up a lot of their own oil. And indeed, they did a lot of suburbanizing over the last 20 years, which is just a tremendous blunder. Norway has only 4.5 million people. They've used quite a bit less. And another part of the oil nationalism story, by the way, is that some nations like Norway, that are nations long acquainted with civilized life are going to keep more of their own oil after a certain point. And they're talking about it. They're making plans to do it. They're not so dumb that they're going to just piss it all away and then turn around and say, oh, how are we going to keep our lights lit or, you know, whatever we need to do with our oil? So increasingly, that's a big deal. Anyway, the North Sea fields were among the last to be discovered, and they were exploited with the latest and greatest technology. And guess what? You know, we never pay any attention to the unintended consequences of technology, but it's a big deal. And the unintended consequence of drilling the North Sea with the latest and greatest technology, horizontal drilling, you know, injections of seawater to pump, get the oil out, the consequence of that was they depleted the North Sea more efficiently. So now the UK has gone from peak production in 1999 to having no exports at all, becoming a net importer of energy in 2006. And that's a remarkable thing. The poster child for the export crisis, Mexico. Mexico gets 60% of all of its oil from one single supergiant oil field called the Cantarell Field. It is depleting at a minimum of 15% a year, although Pemex actually announced in September that it was in 2007 it actually depleted at 17%. And so if you do the simple math, you can see that in a few years it's all gone. So in a few years, 60% of Mexico's oil production will be gone. And well before then, you know, they will lose their ability to send oil to the United States. Now, they happen to be our number three source of imports. Who's our number one source? Right. And number two, of course, Saudi Arabia. So they're number three. And so this means within, you know, before 2010, the U.S. is probably going to lose its number three source of imports. And guess what? That'll have an enormous impact on how we behave in the United States. And there's nothing that we know of that's going to offset that. And meanwhile, export declines are going to continue in all the other countries that send us oil. So for us, it's a tremendous problem. Another problem is that the Mexican government depends on Pemex for 40% of its revenue. So they're going to lose a huge amount of basically tax money, revenue. The social safety net, or what there is of it in Mexico, is going to dissolve, you know, the subsidized tortillas, et cetera. And the last time there was a political convulsion in Mexico, the last time the people became seriously pissed off at their government, 25% of the population of Mexico left. And at that time, the population was 22 million. Now the population of Mexico is over 100 million. So if there's another political convulsion, we're going to have a lot more trouble at the southern border of the United States than we have been. So there are a lot of implications to this. Climate change has been adequately covered by Al Gore, and I don't mean to give it short shrift, but those of you who want to learn about it in detail, go, you know, rent his excellent movie and learn about it. The only point I want to make here is that the problems of climate change and the global oil predicament are going to ramify each other as well. And we saw an excellent example of it in Hurricane Katrina, Category 4-5 hurricane, probably a result of global warming, climate change. You know, we had two Force 5 hurricanes within about a month that year. And they not only did they destroy a major American city, but they also took out 23% of our oil and gas production, at least for the better part of a year after that. So these problems affect each other. And climate change, global warming is certainly very important, but forgive me for not dwelling on it. There are other things I want to talk about tonight. So this whole bundle of problems, I put together and under the rubric of the long emergency, a period of time that would be characterized by discontinuity, by a break between what we knew and what was normal, and what our accustomed behaviors and habits and practices and expectations were, and where we're heading. And a lot of it starts here, in this unfortunate place. What I used to, back in the old urban design days, I used to describe it as the national automobile slum. But now I call it something else. And by the way, that doesn't help up there. The smiling water tower doesn't help because it's not even what it's intended to be. You know, and everybody knows this subconsciously. You know, it's not Mr. Have a Nice Day. It's the face of a wrathful deity. That's what he looks like, you know, when he's not behind the veil. And he's looking down at us saying, you're a wicked people and you're going to be punished. And I'm going to begin by making you live in this. And that's what we've done, you know, and that's where we're at. And it's pretty unpleasant. No one's having a better day down there because of him. In fact, it's, you know, the whole thing is counterintuitive. It only makes people feel worse. You know, they see that, and they reach for the, you know, the Prozac, the Celexa, the Zoloft, down in the console of the Toyota. Anyway, you know, I stopped referring to this necessarily in urban design terms now, and now I describe it as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And it's an enormous problem. The reason you call it that, the reason you can say it's the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world is because it has no future. And we poured all of our national treasure into building an infrastructure for daily life that has no future. And all of its accessories and all of its furnishings, the strip malls, the box stores, the highways, the parking lagoons, you know, the whole ensemble, you know, we've from sea to shining sea, you know, from Florida to British Columbia, we've poured our wealth into these environments, and they have no future. And unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of consequences of that. One is that it automatically provokes a psychology of previous investment, which means that, you know, having put so much of your wealth and indeed your identity into this way of life, into the equipment for running this way of life, you can't imagine changing it. You can't imagine letting go of it or giving it up. And that's probably the main reason behind the fact that we're not having a coherent conversation, a coherent public discussion about what we're going to do about these problems. And indeed, it's behind the fact that the only discussion we're really having is how we're going to prop this stuff up by other means, you know, other means than petroleum. There are additional problems that are entailed by this. One is that you know, in the 1990s, the United States basically got rid of its manufacturing economy. And then we pretended that we replaced it with something really snazzy. You know, at times we called it the information economy. And then at times we said, oh, it's a service economy. But that was all nonsense. It was really a suburban sprawl building economy. And that's what eventually was expressed in the housing bubble, you know, which was the climactic efflorescence of this activity. And what it really amounted to was devoting the last 15 years to building even more stuff that has no future. You know, a tragic behavior, a set of tragic choices. The truth is life is tragic. People, cultures make unhappy choices, unfortunate choices. About 40% of the jobs that were created from the 90s on in the United States were created in the housing bubble, suburban sprawl building industry, including the production home builders and the realtors and the mortgage originators and salespeople and the financiers who were packaging the mortgages into bogus securities. And the guys who were installing the granite countertops and the developers of the furnishings and accessories, the malls and strip malls, the Home Depots, et cetera, et cetera. And if you subtract all that employment from the United States employment, what's left is hairstyling, fried chicken, and open heart surgery. And that's all. So naturally, the collapse of the housing bubble is very traumatic because there are most of the positions in open heart surgery and fried chicken are occupied. We don't need any more of those guys. So this has been an enormous problem, and it is now unraveling in your neighbor to the south. It hasn't unraveled here yet, and one of the things that I found curious and indeed even a little disturbing was the pervasive suggestion as I was toured around Surrey a few days ago that we're different here. This wouldn't happen to us, you know. And I got a lot of kind of flashes of things out there. And one of the flashes I got out in Surrey was, you know, this is exactly what they thought in Atlanta and Phoenix 24 months ago. Oh, it's different here. This would never happen to us. And I really wonder. I got another flash out in Surrey, too, which, you know, may be of some interest to the planning and architecture community here. The interesting thing is you've done a great job, given the nature of the car-dependent culture. You know, you have done a great job out in the asteroid belt of Surrey in assembling density. But what you've done, what you've managed to do is assemble density with absolutely no artistry. You know, it's monotonous, boring, ugly, and unfortunately, I think what you're going to see as a consequence of that is a lot of people in the metro area are going to come to the conclusion that density is the problem. You know, you cannot afford to do density that is not beautiful, that does not create good public spaces, that does not include good, well-detailed streets and a few good buildings every now and again, not just production, cookie-cutter stuff. And that's the big lesson from Surrey, among other things. We'll get to that in a little while. But as far as the United States goes, you know, I think the salient point is that, you know, a lot of people in the United States that are in the suburban sprawl building industry really think that we're at the bottom of a cycle, or we're nearing the bottom of a cycle, or we're heading down to the bottom of the cycle. What they don't get is it's not the cycle anymore. It's over. There's going to be no more cycles of suburban sprawl building. We're not going to build anymore, because by the time this fiasco is worked out, and it's going to take years to work it out, including figuring out who even owns the defaulted mortgages, which have been sliced and diced and dissociated and deployed as far away as the Norwegian substitute teachers union, you know, owning little pieces of McHouses in Illinois and Nevada, and oh my God, what do we do? You know, how are they going to foreclose on that stuff? You know, it's going to take forever to work this stuff out, and by the time they do, we're going to be, we will have entered the real robust stage of the oil problem, and then it will be self-evident that we can't live like this anymore. So this is the end of that. It's not the bottom of the cycle. We're just not going to do it. There are a lot of other compelling reasons why we're not going to do this anymore. One is that any way you cut it or slice it and dice it, we're going to have some kind of problems with industrial agriculture. You know, the whole process of taking the oil-based inputs and the gas-based fertilizers and the herbicides and putting it on the soil and getting the little crops of the cheese doodles out of the ground, that's not going to be working for us anymore. And we're going to have to grow our food differently. You know, we're not going to be able to transport it that far. The age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad will be coming to an end. And so one of the main implications of this is that in the places where we still do have remaining good arable farmland around the metro areas and around the towns, we can't even afford to dedicate it anymore to suburban house building. So we're going to have to get serious about a new kind of productive landscape. And for the environmentalists out there, this is going to require quite a mental shift. You know, for one reason or another, and for better or for worse, the environmental movement has been unduly preoccupied with scenic and recreational issues. And the rural landscape is not just about scenic and recreational issues. You know, it's going to be increasingly about what is the relationship between the urban habitats of all scales and a productive farming habitat and ecology that has to be different from, you know, that is not just scenic and recreational. And that's going to be a big consideration for us.
You are listening to James Howard Kunstler speaking for the Urban Studies Program of Simon Fraser University, January 24, 2008. We'll be right back after 30 seconds for station identification. Welcome back to James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere and the Long Emergency.
Most of the delusional thinking that's floating around out there has tended to focus on the issue of alternative fuels and systems for running them. And I think that the truth of the matter is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for doing them will permit us to live the way we're living, or even a substantial fraction of the way we're living. No combination of solar or wind or tidal or nuclear or biodiesel or ethanol or used French fried potato oil is going to allow us to keep Walmart and the interstate highway system and Walt Disney World running. We're going to try everything. We probably should try most of these things. But the bottom line is we're going to be disappointed in what these things can do for us. And unfortunately, a lot of the delusional thinking that is out there is really involves fantasies, grandiose fantasies about what technology is going to be able to do for us. And the conclusion that I think we must draw from this is that it can't be about running all this stuff by other means. It's got to be about making other arrangements comprehensively. We are going to use almost all these other things. But, for example, you know, we have a lot of fantasies about putting up giant wind farms all over North America. I don't believe we're going to do it. I think we'll put up some. But I think that what you're going to find out is that these things will be used on a household basis, on maybe a neighborhood basis or a district basis. But we're not going to be putting up that many of these giant wind farms. And we're going to run into another problem further down the road, because we're not only dealing with peak oil, we're dealing with peak metals, peak exotic alloys, peak materials needed for the fabrication the turbines, which require very exotic materials and methods of fabrication that are expensive. So if we could do this stuff on a household and neighborhood basis, that's probably the scale that we need to think about. And remember what I said earlier, behind all this is the issue of what is the appropriate scale for living, for everyday life in North America, or among civilized people. And many of the alt-fuel fantasies are about continuing to live at the wrong scale by other means. Okay, and we're not going to be able to do that. This was an interesting utterance made in the wake of a great trauma, the 9/11 attack, when the people in the U.S. needed some psychological support. The trouble with it is that it doesn't comport with the way the universe works. Unfortunately, if you don't negotiate the circumstances that the universe sends at you, you get assigned a new negotiating partner named reality. And then it negotiates for you. You don't even have to be in the room anymore. You know? And that's really what's happening. You know, this is actually a belief that, you know, 90% of the people down in the United States actually subscribe to. And unfortunately, if they don't negotiate, then they're simply going to, you know, have to do what circumstances dictate that they must do. That they'll have to do what events compel them to do, and they'll have less and less to say about it the longer they stay out of the conversation. So, you know, there are some major obstacles to our ability to think coherently and to mount a public discussion about these issues that makes sense. And one of them is this. You know, in this media-saturated culture, it's now become normal for adults in North America to think that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. It's a nice thought for a six-year-old child, but it's not a good idea for most adults to believe this. You know, because among other things, you know, one of the hallmarks of being an adult is knowing the difference between wishing for stuff and making stuff happen. And a whole, you know, continent full of people who think that just wishing for stuff will make things happen, you know, they are going to be very disappointed. It's accompanied by this other idea. Actually, this is America's newest and fastest growing religion, okay, which is not evangelical Christianity. It's the worship of unearned riches. And it's based on the theological idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. Now, that also is inconsistent with the way the universe works, but is now become a normative belief throughout most of adult America. So you combine these two, you know, what have become two normal ideas in America now, the idea that it's that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true, and that when you wish upon a star, you'll get something for nothing. And that's where we're at with the alternative energy situation. We're all sitting around wishing to get something for nothing, and it's not going to happen. By the way, here they are at their devotions. And I saw a really interesting example of this about a year and a half ago. I was invited to give a talk at the Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And I went down there, and their headquarters are in an office park building in some jive plastic suburb in near San Jose somewhere. And it was really interesting. The whole building was tricked out like a kindergarten. Okay? They had knock hockey sets and foosball games and ping pong and video game consoles, and they had the Lucite boxes with the gummy bears and the yogurt-covered pretzels. And, you know, it was the perfect kindergarten. And this is the highest level of corporate enterprise now in America, you know? And so I thought, oh, it's nice. They're very playful. Isn't that cute? And then we went into the auditorium, which was a much larger space than this even, and the Google executives and senior engineers came in, okay? And they were dressed like skateboard rats. You know, they had like sideways hats on. You know, their pants were, their ass crack was showing because their pants were falling down. Like, dude. I've become addicted to that. Like, dude. And so, you know, I gave my spiel about energy, and at the time I was not talking about Google, right? Because, you know, I hadn't been there before, so I wasn't talking about it. And so I gave my spiel about energy, and, you know, we got a problem with energy, blah, 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 blah. And we did, like, comments and questions afterwards, and 17 guys got up afterwards, and there were no questions. They all made the same comment. And the comment was, like, dude, we've got technology. Subtext, you're an asshole. Case dismissed. But, you know, I soon realized what I was seeing, you know, was that I realized finally that, you know, all this juvenilia going on around me. I realized that, you know, these were the senior engineers and executives of Google. These were people who had become multi-millionaires, you know, at age 27. And they had accomplished it by moving pixels around a screen with a mouse, okay? So that they had developed this grandiose delusion that all of the sorrows of mankind could be solved by pushing pixels around a screen with a mouse, you know? And the trouble with that is what it fundamentally meant was they really didn't know the difference between energy and technology. They thought that they were the same. You know, that you could substitute one for the other. If you run out of energy, dude, get some technology. Get an iPod. Listen to some tunes. And, you know, this is happening at the highest level of technological enterprise in America, okay? This wasn't the Acme bowling pin company. This was the new economy. This was Silicon Valley. You know, this is the Brazilian dollar company. And so, you know, if they don't get it, you know, what if they don't get it at the highest level of American technology, who's going to get it, you know? So the delusional thinking is just amazing, you know? Okay. You know, go get 100,000 iPods, grind them up, and put them in there. And then we'll take off, okay? So we're going to run these things. Either we're going to run these things on the stuff they're used to running on, namely liquid hydrocarbon, you know, kerosene-like aviation fuel, or we're not going to have an aviation industry of the kind that we've been used to. And the prospect is that we're not. You know, we're not. And we can already see that's another one of the complex systems out there that's wobbling, and that is like looking like it's sooner or later is going to fail. And we're not going to change out the hardware. You know, we're either going to run the Boeing 707s and 37s and 57s and blah, 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 and the Airbuses, et cetera, or we're not going to, these companies aren't going to run. Certainly not going to run the way they're running. So technology is not energy. And this, of course, is, you know, this is basically the fundamental idea that's lurking in the delusional mind is that there's some, you know, there's some meta, some group of meta scientists out there who are going to magically deliver all these rescue remedies to us, and that is not helpful. These ideas and these delusional thoughts are really being expressed most clearly in the salient theme that has emerged from this in the popular debate. In other words, the only thing that we're really talking about all across North America is how we're going to run the cars by other means, you know? And everybody's excited about it, you know? People come up to me after a talk and they say, dude, I got a Prius, you know? And they don't get it. It's not about, you know, the fact that the cars we're running are too big and too powerful. It's about the fact that we're running too many cars incessantly, okay, of all kinds. I don't care whether it's a Prius or a Cadillac Escalando or a Plymouth Inflicta. It doesn't really matter. But the important point is that we have to change the subject. And when you go to your cocktail parties, when you go to your you know, your dinner parties, meet with your friends, talk casually about the energy problem, if it comes up next time there's a gas hike or anything like that, you know, we got to start changing the subject and not just talk about how we're going to run the cars by biodiesel or, you know, use French fried potato oil. We got to start talking about making other arrangements for all of these complex systems that we depend on, not just the motoring. And these two can be, you know, we can form a comprehensive to-do list about all these things, that all these tasks that we face. Very clear, you know, at the upper right there, we're going to have to do agriculture different. You know, we have no idea how we're going to do this differently, but we're probably going to have to do it in smaller units, smaller farms, and it will probably require some amount more of human attention than it's getting now. Because we're going to be able to run fewer machines. You know, I don't know whether it's, you know, no machinery at all or 90% of the machinery we're running now. We really don't know, but it's going to change. We got to do it differently. And if there are additional social problems with land itself and with farmland itself that I'm going to go into a little later.
You are listening to James Howard Kunstler, speaking for the Urban Studies Program of Simon Fraser University, January 24th, 2008.
The bottom right, we're going to have to do shopping differently. You know, we're going to have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency that were systematically destroyed, by the way, with our permission completely, you know, that were destroyed by the Walmarts and the Target stores, et cetera. We don't know how we're going to rebuild these networks. Human societies tend to be self-organizing and emergent in response to the stuff that's happening and the circumstances of our times. And that's probably what will happen, but it is not necessarily going to be a smooth transition. We're going to have to do it whether we like it or not. The national chain stores are not going to survive the changes to their business equations, you know. And you can state, you know, pretty categorically what that means. The warehouse on wheels that Walmart uses to move all of its stuff around by, you know, putting all of its stuff in tractor trailer trucks and circulating them incessantly around North America on the highways. Okay, that is not going to work after a while. That's going to fail. So they're going to have problems with their 12,000-mile supply line to Asia, where all the plastic salad shooters are coming from. We're going to have far fewer plastic salad shooters. Their customer base is going to have far less disposable income for buying the stuff. That's going to change too. So in many different directions and dimensions, they're going to become unstable and not be able to do business the way they've been accustomed to it. Okay, the lower center. We're going to have to do school differently because the centralized school districts, the way they're set up, are going to get into a lot of trouble. We're going to have to make things differently. We have no idea how we're going to start manufacturing a lot of the stuff that we have outsourced again. Probably the answer is we're going to manufacture a whole lot less stuff and have a whole lot less stuff to buy, and that buying stuff is going to, you know, the blue light fiesta of shopping is now going to fade into the background of our lives. It's not going to be in the forefront of our lives anymore. And finally, we're going to have to occupy the terrain of North America differently than we have. And it will probably take the form of what has been called the new urbanism. Only the new urbanism is not going to be the new urbanism anymore. It's going to be the only urbanism. It's going to be traditional urbanism, because that's really what the new urbanists did. Was the great achievement of the new urbanists was not creating the new towns or the, you know, trying to accommodate the car and make it better. You know, their real achievement was just diving into the dumpster of history and retrieving lost principle and methodology that had been thrown away by previous generations of professionals, the architects and the planners who tossed the stuff in the garbage in 1950 and decided, oh, we can just use statistical analysis and traffic engineering and everything will come out just great. And we see the result of that now all over North America in these horrible strip mall environments absolutely everywhere. What it probably means, really, is that we're going to have to return to traditional human environments, the kind we've had for the last, you know, 10,000 years, except for the period after World War II. And that means neighborhoods, villages, hamlets, towns, slightly bigger towns, small cities, some bigger cities, you know, and urban places, in short, and urban places that exist in a meaningful relationship with a surrounding productive agricultural landscape. And it's going to be very difficult because in many cases the agricultural landscape is now cluttered up with muffler shops and you know, subdivisions. But we are going to have to get back to that some way. I'll try to describe some ways we can do that. Now, you know, we're fortunate in this way in the East because we have a lot of the older fabric in those habitats that is scaled appropriately to what the future is going to require. You have a lot less of that in the west of North America, but there's quite a bit in Vancouver. In fact, a lot of the new stuff in Vancouver is actually appropriately scaled. So you're very fortunate here. What we have to do is actually emulate the best stuff that's appropriately scaled and consider that to be those things to be our models. We have no idea how we're going to do this. We may be using more animals, but, you know, I don't know whether it's 3% or 33% or 83%. We just don't know how this is going to happen yet. This diagram, I'm not fond of statistics or anything, but it's so striking. The amount of retail space that we have dedicated per person in the United States compared to other civilized countries, you know? And the conclusion to draw from this is we don't need another single silver souvenir spoon shop on this continent. You know, we are so over-retailed, it's not funny. And as an observer, I was standing watching a dead mall in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a local guy from there a year or so ago. And we were just both sort of marveling at this, and he turned to me and he said, "I don't think we need that many evangelical roller rinks around here." No, we don't have any idea what we're going to do with this stuff. Most of it is probably not going to be reused. You know, we have a lot of fantasies that we're going to just reuse it. Actually, one of the things we're going to see is that we will have far fewer modular fabricated building materials to use. We're not going to be manufacturing as many, and probably at some point hardly any at all. And so a lot of this stuff is simply going to be disassembled for its value as either, you know, trusses, or just for the metal itself, or for the panels, or, you know, for one thing or another. Very little of it, I think, is going to be turned into, you know, we have fantasies that we're going to turn it into skateboard parks and things like that. Forget about it. I've already actually covered this. We have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency. One of the things that happened as a sort of a side consequence of losing that was, you know, we had these systems that not only provided economic roles for people in a locality, but also social roles that they played that combined. You know, they were integral to each other. They were woven together so that a person was a storekeeper, but he was also the employer of a local person. He also participated in the local decisions about his town. He generally, or he or she, generally owned two pieces of property in the town or the city, the place where they did business and the place that they lived. And they took care of these places. You know, they were the caretakers of the civic institutions. They sat on the boards of the library and the hospital, and they managed the Little League. You know, now in the States, if you want to have a Little League team, you have to apply to the state of New York for a grant, because the people who supported those institutions are no longer in place in the social and retail network. In my part of the country, most of the factories in the Hudson and Mohawk Valley, which was a very dense industrial part of the United States, most of these factories are now being bulldozed. They're not even there anymore, even if we wanted to build stuff in them. The one thing that we have left in that part of the world is we have a lot of water power, because we have rivers that move, that fall down, that have waterfalls, and we could generate a lot of power to actually have factories again. But it will probably be a matter of scale. You know, they're not going to be the same scale as the factories that evolved in 1910, 1920, as we ramped up the energy trail. Because now we're going down, and we're going to probably have to do it on a much more modest basis if we do it at all. You know, one of the more tragic focal points of the psychology of previous investment is in these centralized school districts. Because, you know, that's where the communities have really spent their money, on these fabulous facilities, you know, with the gyms and the pools and the tracks and the, you know, acres and acres of parking and all the fabulous accommodations. They're probably going to fail. You know, we're not going to be able to keep hauling the kids around the 50-mile radius pupil sheds and collecting them every morning and then redistributing them in the afternoon. You know, but at the same time, we're going to be a far less affluent society, because we, you know, at the same time, we're going to be going through what can be called pretty much a crisis of capital. including a crisis of having more investment money to do the, to fix this. And so I think what you'll see is that the next incarnation of schooling in the United States, anyway, is going to be probably homeschooling that will then aggregate into larger groups. You know, but we're not going to rebuild the schools and then distribute the smaller schools, for the most part, you know, around the places where the people live. And then notice the quality of the schools that we built. You know, the in your upper right there, the Hannibal Lecter Central School. Because that's how we do it. You know, we build them like maximum security prisons. The Sierra Club has been there, notice. Thank you very much. That helps a lot. But we got to do better than that. We, you know, and it's also ironic. I mean, this is sort of a similar kind of thing as the phenomenon I described with the bankers all forgetting, you know, as a whole group, forgetting overnight that you have to have lending standards, okay? The educators forgot overnight that school buildings have to be dignified. You know, that kids need to feel okay about going into these places. They have to understand that school is a privileged activity and a wonderful privileged activity and not a punishment. And how we got the idea that school buildings should express the idea of punishment, it's really a remarkable thing that that's exactly what happened when, you know, just like the bankers became psychotic over their lending standards, the educators became psychotic over their architectural standards. So, you know, you begin to see the manifestations of a broadly psychotic culture.
That's all the time we have for this week. Tune into Radio EcoShock next week for the last 20 minutes of the speech and a fascinating question and answer period, plus a few notes on the author. This speech by James Howard Kunstler was as the first visiting professor to the Simon Fraser University Urban Studies program. To learn more about that program, go to www.sfu.ca/urban. Kunstler's homepage is simply kunstler.com, spelled KUNSTLER.com. Watch for his new novel about life in America after the oil age, titled World Made by Hand. That's coming out in March. The Vancouver lecture was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find Mr. Kunstler's presentation at our website at ecoshock.org on the Peak Oil page. I'd like to thank Mr. Kunstler, his publishers, and Simon Fraser University for permission to record this speech for nonprofit college and community radio stations. Join us next week on Radio EcoShock for the conclusion of James Howard Kunstler speaking in Vancouver. Hear that program live on the web Fridays at 1 o'clock at www.cooperadio.org/listen, or sign up for our podcast, or you can download it to your computer or iPod from the Peak Oil page at ecoshock.org. We'll go out with a bit of David Rovex singing about the end of the age of oil.
It was as if there was a contest to see how many holes could be dug, to see how much of it could be sucked from the ground, to kill off every beetle and bug, to kill off every woman and child, and to kill off every man. And they put it all in barrels, and they put the barrels into cans. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was like a competition to see how big everything could get, from the highways to the strip malls to the giant TV sets, from the Moabs to the drag lines, monster trucks and SUVs, and the massive roaring chainsaws that cut down all the trees. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. It was as if there was some kind of test, and the only way to pass was to turn the planet's atmosphere into a cloud of poison gas. It was like the only thing that mattered was the death of life on Earth. That seemed to be the proof that you had made your money's worth. That's how it was at the end of the age of oil. At the end of the age of oil.